Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
Listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Alyssa Mastromonaco worked as a top aide for President Barack Obama for over 10 years, serving as assistant to the president and deputy chief of staff for operations at the White House from 2011 to 2014. She was one of the youngest women to ever serve in that position and the first woman to occupy an office whose previous inhabitants included the likes of George Stephanopoulos, Rahm Emanuel, Karl Rove, and David Plouffe. In her new book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House, Ms. Mastromonaco gives a behind-the-scenes account of her time working for President Obama and offers insights into how politics and government work. She's currently the chief operating officer at Vice Media. Her book is published by 12 Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Leonard, thank you.
Weren't you once included in a list of Washington's most powerful, least famous people?
I was.
What exactly does the president's deputy chief of staff operations do?
I oversaw everything on what we called the 18 acres, which was the campus of the White House. And then, so that included everything from the White House military office that ran Camp David, that maintained Air Force One and Marine One, to overseeing presidential personnel. So I was one of the people who would interview Jim Comey to be head of the FBI or Jack Lew to be Treasury Secretary. What else? Oversaw scheduling and advance, which was my previous post, which manages all of the logistics and strategy around the president's travel, how he uses his time here and abroad. So that was sort of the scope of my remit.
You write that a lot of people often ask you how a public school kid from upstate New York with no connections and no Ivy League acceptance letters ended up working for the President of the United States just a few feet from the Oval Office. And what do you tell them?
I tell them that, you know, I didn't grow up saying I want to work in the White House. I got into politics when I was in college. I was always interested, you know, like I grew up, I watched the Iran-Contra hearings on TV. I saw Bernie Sanders when I was in Vermont, and Burlington is really political, and I decided to intern, and it ended up being this sort of, you know, transformative experience. And it wasn't because I saw power brokers. It was because I saw that if people are really committed to public service, that someone who calls up with a problem can get it solved.
At that time, did you ever think that he might run for president?
Oh, no, never. I mean, he always seemed someone who was just super contented serving the people of Vermont. And I always sort of followed my gut and my heart and worked for people that I deeply believed in.
Wasn't he also limiting his opportunities by not being a member of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party?
You know, I think that maybe he was, but at the same time, the authenticity that had him just sort of a tried and true independent is ultimately, I think, what brought people to, you know, embrace him in 2015.
What did you do after you graduated from college?
After I graduated from college and I spent the entire summer mailing my resumes around Capitol Hill, not getting a response to any one of them, my very best friend from Rhinebeck, New York, and I decided to move to the city together. She was going to the new school. And I actually took a job as a paralegal in the World Trade Center.
And you say forward motion is always better than no motion, even if you don't think it's taking you in the direction you wanted to go.
Yes. For me, wallowing was never a good look. I would sort of get quite depressed. And so for me, doing something is better than doing nothing. And so even though I had a collection of sort of very strange jobs for part of my life, it was always better and I always learned something.
How did you get involved with John Kerry's 2004 presidential campaign?
I got involved with John Kerry because when my one of my roommates, who was my colleague at the as a paralegal. She ended up going to law school. I went to visit her in Boston. And John Kerry was giving a speech, and I saw it, and I said, what am I doing? You know, I got to get back in it. I can't give up.
What were you working at the time?
At the time, I was a client services manager at Sotheby's International.
Sounds like good preparation for what you
done. I have
done.
To tell you, it was a lovely job. I mean, it was kind of hard to leave. But I actually wrote a letter just asking to be an intern and figured I would figure out how to make my money somehow. And they hired me as a staff assistant.
And what was memorable about working on the Kerry campaign, other than the fact that they had 13 different slogans?
13 different slogans. There was an actual poem written about the 13 different slogans, which we still all have. But it was the first time I felt in my professional life that I was really the tip of the spear, where I had real decision-making responsibility, where I oversaw, you know, probably a couple hundred people, part-time and full-time. So that was really memorable. And also the heartbreak of losing is very memorable.
You write about how stressful campaigns are and mm-hmm. how the physical and about the physical toll that they take on you. How do they take a physical toll on you?
Well, most people either get really skinny or really fat. I unfortunately got quite chubby because you are working all the time. You are on all the time. And there were times when we would eat quite unhealthily, where bagels with extra cheese and meat became the rule, not the exception.
What did you learn from his loss on election night in 2004?
Well, I learned that life goes on. I learned that just because things aren't fair, that, you know, doesn't matter. That's how it is.
Were you surprised because a lot of the country was upset that we had gone into a couple of unpopular wars?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that sometimes the interesting thing is I think we spent a lot of time trying to, because there were several wars going on and we were running against a sitting president, I think that we focused too much on still trying to make America think he was smart when maybe he just needed to seem more relatable and like he was on their side.
Did you expect to work for another campaign after that one?
No, I never wanted to work on one again. I didn't.
You write that when you first met Barack Obama in 2004, you weren't sure that he liked you very much.
Yeah, he's a tough customer.
Why did you think that?
He's pretty, you know, laid back, and some people have said aloof, but he's actually not aloof at all. He's just not very emotive sometimes. And I met with him, and he was really concerned with the fact that I wasn't from Illinois.
And why that?
Because he was the junior senator from Illinois. Senator Durbin had been there for a long time, and he had a real connection also to downstate and didn't want people thinking that after that speech he gave at the convention that he had gone Hollywood. So a connection to Illinois was very important to him.
So were you surprised when he offered you the job?
Yes, I was, because normally I think that I have a real sense when I walk out of something whether I was a hit or a miss, and I thought I was probably a miss after I met with him.
When he was on this show to talk about his memoir,
yep.
I asked him whether he had any plans to run for president because there were rumors. He said, no. He said, I'm, 48th in line.
Yes.
I'll be sharpening pencils for a long time before
yes.
I ever think of the White House. And, of course, months later, he announced.
He did. And I have to tell you that when he talked to you about that, he was telling you the God's honest truth. It was really after the book came out and he was in Africa. I actually managed his book tour, which gave me good insights for mine. And the enthusiasm, the outpouring of what he meant to people really became apparent as something he should probably think about doing. It was a if not now, then when sort of thought.
I'm speaking with Alyssa Mastromonaco, who, with the help of Lauren Euler, has written Who Thought That Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House. Doesn't the title of your book come from a 2008 campaign event for Obama?
It comes from many years of Obama, punctuated by an event in 2008, which was if then-Senator Obama and ultimately President Obama did not like what you had decided he was going to be doing, you would get an email either from him or one of the folks who traveled with him that would say something like, Philly event, who thought this was a good idea, question mark, when they knew all well that I was the one who thought it was a good idea. And so in 2008, it was about 2 weeks before the election, President Obama, it's no secret, does not like the cold. He's from Hawaii. And it was quite cold in Pennsylvania, and it was going to snow. And we didn't have an indoor location. We had an outdoor location with no, you know, rain site or bad weather site. And we said, look, you know, McCain's canceling all of his events. His events were outdoors. We are going to crush this. We are going to just, you are going to dominate Philly, you know, Pennsylvania television. And I talked to David Plouffe, who is the campaign manager. We said, yeah, we're going to keep it. And then we emailed The Road, and we said, you know, guys, you're going to keep that event in Chester. And they said, you know, who thought this was a good idea? And worst case scenario was that it wasn't snow, it was sleet, pelted him in the face. And the reason that we love the story so much is because the photos taken by the Washington Post won the Pulitzer that year. And so we, when it won, we were like, this was Chester. Look at the picture. That was Chester. And so...
So did he come to think it might have been a good idea?
Yeah, he did. We all got a good giggle for years to come off of that one.
Was he different as president?
No.
The office doesn't change people?
I think it changes people. I think that between the president and the first lady and having the girls there, having Sasha and Malia, I think that he, the person I saw, remained quite constant.
But you say he never yelled or demeaned people, but his most common way of expressing displeasure with a staffer was a raised eyebrow.
Raised eyebrow.
How was election night 2008 different from your election night experience 4 years earlier?
So 4 years earlier in 2004, we thought we were going to win. We were believing exit polls. We all went out. We started celebrating quite early, and we were just drunk enough by the time we found out that we were losing, and that instead of a celebratory event, we had to plan a concession event. That was so traumatic that in 2008, I was, hyper superstitious. So I went out. It was supposed to be beautiful weather in Chicago. I went to North Face and bought a raincoat just because I thought it would ward away the rain. It did. I'll take credit for that. But I stayed in the office as late as I possibly could, and I wouldn't go out. And when they called Ohio, we went and we had our on the campaign, we like to go to Houlihan's for chicken tenders and Pinot Grigio. And so we started doing that. And then they called New Mexico and I think maybe Pennsylvania. And we had these trolleys to take us down to Grant Park. And as we were pulling up, Wolf Blitzer called it. And we couldn't believe it. We started to cry. And Brad Pitt was in our way. We had to like elbow him. We're like, get away. We did this.
So it's kind of a roller coaster ride on most election nights. You think you're going to lose and you think you're going to win. Then maybe, oh, this state might change things again. What was your first day working at the White House like?
It was really overwhelming. You can't even imagine all of the things you don't know when you walk in. And so we actually, my deputy Danielle and I, we couldn't go to inauguration because we were among the first people to be sworn in the White House. And so when everybody was watching him be sworn in, we were walking down 17th Street in sneakers and sad suits.
Because you couldn't go?
Couldn't because the way that the town was shut down, the way that D.C. was cordoned off by police, it would have been impossible to cross over. So we said it was okay. We would watch on TV.
Was the gender imbalance particularly noticeable when you first arrived in the West Wing?
No. I would say that the gender imbalance was more perceived. You know, the press liked to write about it, like, because, you know, Barack Obama is a man. There were male senior advisors, but Valerie Jarrett was also there. And so the argument that some of the women actually had with members of the press was, we're actually there. Are you saying we don't count? Like, what's your story? And so we combated that as much as possible because it wasn't, we didn't feel it was that big of an issue.
And do you think President Trump is having the same problem? Yes, women there.
I believe that, I mean, his imbalance is much greater, but I don't know that he's as sensitive to it as President Obama was or would have been.
I'm speaking with Alyssa Mastromonaco, who served as assistant to the president and director of scheduling and advance at the White House from 2009 to 2011, as an assistant to the president and deputy chief of staff for operations at the White House from 2011 to 2014. Her book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House, is published by 12, which means it's one of only 12 books published by that company in a year. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Alyssa Mastromonaco. Her book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House, was written with the help of Lauren Euler, and it's published by 12. When you were promoted to Deputy Chief of Staff of Operations in 2011, did you have any doubts that about the job? Did you want it?
I did. I was very worried. It was such an immense responsibility. And most of the people who had had the job before me had, you know, some were older. I mean, that was basically all it came down to. And I was nervous. And I went to the president to tell him that I wasn't quite sure. And he came back, and Pete Rouse, who was a senior advisor, a counselor at the time, said, "Alyssa, you're the only person who thinks you can't do this."
You had to deal with a lot of dense briefing binders, you write.
Mm-hmm.
What was intimidating about the White House military office?
So the White House military office, one, is comprised of mostly military. And, I mean, there were in the – I have to remember this because I don't want to misspeak. But the White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations carries the same rank as a two-star officer. And so here I was. I would often do conference calls with people. And the one time I went down, and the first time I chaired a meeting as deputy chief, they were all very courteous. And I sit at the head of the table with these generals and decorated military officers. And I guess my voice was much more serious than my appearances. And they said, we got through the meeting. They said, you know what, you should do meetings on the phone more often because you're much scarier. But we had quite a good relationship, but it was definitely out of my depth.
Did you spend most of your time traveling with the president and the first lady?
I did. I spent a lot of time as director of scheduling in advance for the first 2 years. I did all foreign trips. And then as deputy chief, you take the role of acting chief of staff on trips. So I did more than half the foreign trips and many domestic.
You must have been astounded to be in this situation. You're talking to the top military leaders, as in some cases you're the one
yep.
Who's in command.
That's right.
And then you write about your first trip to the Vatican mm-hmm. with the president. Did you meet the Pope?
I did meet the Pope.
And then you accompanied Obama on his first trip to Iraq in March 2009.
I was the only only female member of the senior staff that was actually on that trip. And it was particularly memorable, not just because I had never been to Iraq before, but because I'd never been on a helicopter before. And we were expected to take quite a raucous helo ride to Baghdad.
Are you just going along, or is this a time when you're doing a lot of work?
Doing a lot of work. When you're doing something like the trip to Iraq, which was our first and also, I think, the only trip that we tacked on to an existing trip. So we had done our first visit to Turkey. And instead of going back to the U.S. and then going to Iraq, we decided to go to Iraq from Turkey, which is not standard practice. And so we were negotiating with the folks on the ground. And when you actually leave Turkey, you go into – or anywhere, you go into a radio blackout so no one can see the plane coming. And when we sort of went back into communications, when we turned the comms back on, we found out there was a terrible sandstorm in Baghdad and that we weren't going to be able to helo. And so in the 45 minutes from comms going back on to landing, we had to come up with an entirely different plan for what we'd be doing.
And was the question asked again, who thought this was a good idea?
No, we didn't even have time to ask questions at that point.
So what did you do?
What we did was one of my great deputies, Emmett, was on the ground. He was working with General Ordierno, who was helping us on the trip. And what we actually did was we landed at Camp Victory, and we used General Ordierno's house, which I think was the home of Saddam Hussein's mother-in-law. And the leaders came to us, actually. They came via ground transport.
You include a brief interlude for some preparedness tips in your book. What do you mean when you talk about that, being that kind of preparedness?
Preparedness? I think that I probably would have like a pretty serious anxiety disorder if I weren't prepared, and I combat it with, for example, the state dinners are wonderful experiences, but they are work, they are not parties. And the First Lady very much expected that we would understand and have, you know, bits of conversation to have with whomever was seated to our right and our left from the hosting country. I always packed for every occasion. I mean, we could traverse three different climates in the course of one trip. And so it was always about taking a minute and looking ahead and making a list of what we needed so we didn't forget.
Is it possible to have a private life when you're doing all of this?
It's quite hard. I did not go on many dates in the White House.
Now, preparedness can't prepare you for certain things. A poll released just this month reveals that only 57% of registered voters believe that Barack Obama was born in the United States. That's this month. That despite the fact that Donald Trump disavowed the birther charge last September. Was the birther issue a major concern throughout the Obama presidency? Was it something that you had to keep on dealing with?
No. I think that once he was, you know, on the campaign, it was a problem. I remember the first... Goodness, I can't even remember, because I thought the birther thing was so insane. It's like, how can people even believe it? And I think that we did get to a point where this wasn't as big an issue. And then Donald Trump became president. And even though he disavowed it, it was in such a tepid way that I think it gave sort of fire to the idea again that somehow he wasn't actually a citizen.
You write that while your job wasn't policy focused, you often sat in on policy meetings. Why were you invited?
It was very important for the most senior members of the team to understand what was going on in the world, how the president was thinking, what was going to be coming up in terms of executing what he was going to be doing, planning for him, the First Lady, the Vice President, and the cabinet. We needed to have a very strong understanding of what initiatives were and why they were important.
You once sat in on a discussion about food stamps with a group of Ivy League-educated policy experts. And what prompted you to weigh in on the discussion?
So I like to call myself – there were meetings that if I was not actively participating in, I would call myself an auditor, basically. And they were talking about food stamps. And I had actually worked at the grocery store in Rhinebeck, New York, that, as I recall, was the only one for quite a few miles that took food stamps. And I saw what it was like for people who would come through with their groceries, like not this sort of, you know, this lore that people say. People are like scamming off of food stamps all the time. These were families that I knew that came through and were trying to buy what they needed, and they couldn't in some cases. And so listening to people sort of theoretically talk about the impact it would have on people when I knew the impact it had had, I felt like I had to stand up and say something.
And did have much impact?
It did. The president, I was sitting behind the president, and he turned around and he listened to me. And I remember he said, "Good for you."
Alyssa Mastromonaco, her book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea and Other Questions You Should Have Answers to While You Work in the White House. It's published by 12. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You said that the summer of 2012 was one of the most challenging periods in your professional life. Because... The re-election campaign?
Because, so as deputy chief for operations, you, on the one hand, have all of your existing responsibilities that I mentioned earlier. But then I was also the liaison with the campaign because the one thing that Barack Obama cared very much about, and so did all of us, is that we followed all rules and protocols, that we weren't, you know, doing anything politically in the White House that we shouldn't have been doing. There was that. It also involved managing the campaign. And then towards the end of the summer, early fall, Benghazi happened. So there was a lot happening.
And then Hurricane Sandy. Are you surprised that everybody, the people in Congress, want to rush through the whole Russian investigation, but were perfectly happy to keep Benghazi going for years and years?
It's incredible.
Does that drag on the White House, or is it just a minor annoyance?
You know, I think it anything that diverts attention from things that could be happening that are productive, you know, is a drag. But I think they tried to sort of charge on.
What was your role in coordinating the federal response to Hurricane Sandy?
So the deputy chief for operations usually oversees internal response. And in this case, it was so massive, it was going to hit such an incredible population center, that I coordinated with John Brennan, who is now CIA director, but then was assistant to the president for counterintel and homeland security, and Secretary Napolitano. Between the three of us, we sort of like got into the storm. We saw it coming. I think it crossed over Puerto Rico October 25th. We prepared and did sort of pre-landfall declarations, but once the hurricane was, you know, approaching New York, I was able to, with the Department of Energy, Transportation, Agriculture, I sort of oversaw everything so that there was not one lever that wasn't being pulled, which is what the president said he wanted.
You were working primarily with the governor's offices in New Jersey and New York, but then you say at one point you went rogue. What happened?
So everybody, and this is a personal thing, everybody has their own way of how they want to do things, but it was, I had just started learning how to use Twitter. I was following the New York One Twitter feed, and I saw that, you know, the borough presidents and local officials, they were tweeting, and when we were doing a call, an update call with Governor Cuomo, his office said, you know what, it's fine, we'll just do the call with the governor and the senators. And I said, you know, I really think that we should include the borough presidents and some other, like, local folks. And they said, no, it would be fine. But I felt so much that this was going to be so intense that the president really, in order to really get done what we needed to get done, that he needed to hear from the county executives and the borough presidents. And the governor's office ended up being totally fine with it. They were lovely to deal with.
Why did you decide to leave the White House in 2014?
Couple reasons. One, it's a pretty exhausting job, and you're cruising off of adrenaline for, you know, in my case, it had been since 2007. And I felt that, you know, I had seen so much that, one, I was totally exhausted, and felt that my attitude was maybe not the best, and that whereas I'd always felt like I gave 120%, I was maybe hovering a little below 100. And that I knew that there was a really wonderful person to step up and take my place, and that, you know, she deserved the opportunity to have the experiences that I did.
Did you consider staying in politics and government?
No.
You wanted to go do something totally new?
I felt at that point that my identity was so wrapped up in Barack Obama and everything that we had done, that I wanted to try something totally radical and different and, you know, try and reinvent myself.
So you went to Vice Media.
I went to Vice Media.
Did you speak with any former Obama staffers after the November election?
This November?
No.
I did, yes.
Was there a sense that you were still involved with politics in your head?
You know, I think that so many of us, you know, when you go into the White House, there are always the people from the administrations before that sort of tell you what you're doing wrong or want to help, and we had our moment, and we wanted to go and let the Clinton folks ascend and do their thing. And then after Election Day, I was on Jon Favreau and Dan Pfeiffer's podcast, and we talked about how it was like our job and our place to get engaged, even if it just meant marching.
What's it like observing President Trump's transition in the first 100 days in light of your own experiences working with the Obama administration? Do you sympathize with them at all, or especially with Trump's deputy chief of staff, Katie Walsh?
Katie Walsh is deputy chief, and also Joe Hagan, who I think was one of the best hires that they made from the Bush administration, and someone who I really thought could keep them on track. I want to be sympathetic, but I feel that that they look at everything that Barack Obama did, that we did, as literally just sport to kill, without understanding, as we did with the Bush administration, that there are a lot of good reasons that things happen, and maybe you should learn why that was before you just try to kill it.
What was your reaction to President Trump's claims that Barack Obama had the Trump Tower wiretapped?
Well, I will be honest. At first, I thought it was an article from The Onion. I could not believe that that a sitting president would say that about someone who had been so gracious to him in the transition. And, you know, shame on him.
A few days after the 2016 election, you published a letter to young women on the Vice Channel for Women called Broadly. Mm-hmm. What did you want young women to know in the wake of Hillary Clinton's loss?
You know, I thought it was pretty interesting because I woke up the next morning after the election and I was still crying because I couldn't believe that not only had Hillary lost, but she lost Donald Trump, which I'm sure was something she took much harder than I did. But I walked into the office and it was like a morgue. And I knew that I had to do something that would sort of I tried to re-energize women and say, this is bad and we can be sad for a while, but we got to get back up at it because politics is a pendulum.
And there was no one working at Vice who supported Donald Trump?
I don't know. I certainly did not ask. There could have been, but this was more about making women feel okay to mourn a little bit.
So now that you are part of the hated media,
yes.
Do you see yourself ever working on another political campaign in the future, perhaps for the Democrat who's going to oppose Trump for re-election in 2020?
I would say that I have always done quite well when I trusted my gut. And if I saw someone who I thought could really do it, who had the right message, who'd be great for the country, and if I thought that I had something to offer them, I would have a hard time saying no.
What about Barack Obama? Are you still in touch?
Yes.
Do you think he's going to remain active in politics, or do you think he just wants to move on?
I think that it will be very hard for him to see. I mean, I can't imagine. The last time I saw him was actually right before he left office. I can't imagine what it is for him to see what's happening now. I would imagine he will be one of the most sought-after surrogates and in the 2018 midterms. But, you know, I do think that in the same way that President Bush let us sit back and do our thing, I think that, you know, he will try to do that as much for Donald Trump as he can. Though I do know that Vice President Biden is up on the Hill today lobbying for Obamacare. So he's already back in the game.
And Hillary Clinton is reportedly has decided to come out of the woods, as they said. But you think that it just hit her that hard that she felt like she had to pretty much go into seclusion for a time?
I think it was really smart of her. And I remember John Kerry did something very similar after 2004. You know, you don't want to do the wrong thing. And so sometimes you just have to take a beat and sit down. And I'm glad she did. She deserved it. She worked really hard.
So what are you doing now at Vice?
So I was at Vice for 2 years,
oh,
and
you're not
actually
there?
I just transitioned. Vice and A&E Networks have a joint venture called Viceland, which is our television network.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I actually oversee Viceland on the A&E side.
And you preparing shows that deal with the topics we've been discussing?
It's all topical. A&E is not really news focused, but it is. We are relevant.
Alyssa Mastromonaco, her book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea and Other Questions You Should Have Answers to When You Work in the White House, is published by 12 Books. And I thank you so much for being on our
show.
Thank
you so much. It's an honor. I appreciate it.
The lines between the political parties seem to grow wider with each passing day, and there are more and more reasons for each of us to believe the way that we do. If you're a liberal, there's a good chance you'll find others who are like-minded here in New York City. But even as a New Yorker, are you feeling more isolated from the rest of the country? And what if you're a Trump supporter in New York City? Either way, do you think it's possible to bridge the gap? And have you tried? We want to hear from you. Call us at 212-433-9692. You can share your thoughts on our show page with a comment at wmyc.org/Lopate or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Have you ever tried to change somebody's mind? Is it possible when you're arguing over something political, something that one side is claiming, the other side is claiming is not true? Is it possible through logic to convince somebody that what they believe is really false news? Why do you think objectively false things continue to be believed? Continued assertions of President Trump, his staff, and many of his supporters that President Obama had Trump Tower wiretapped during the election, despite FBI Director James Comey's testimony to the contrary. Again, we invite you to give us a call here at 212-433-9692 or write to us on our show page at wmyc.org. on Facebook or Twitter, where handle is at Leonard Lopate. There was a piece in the New York Times today by Amanda Taub and Brendan Nyhan who note that despite the fact that Mr. Trump finally disavowed the birth myth that Barack Obama was born in Kenya, the belief by both Republicans and Democrats that Obama was born in the United States has actually decreased since September, as people are falling back on their older beliefs. Time, interestingly, allows people to go back and believe something that they may have stopped believing for a while. I'm curious about another thing. A lot of friends are telling me that, of all political stripes, that they are insisting on Trump-free conversations when they're dining with friends because it just kind of takes over the conversation. It does for supporters and also for opponents. So let's get to some of those calls. 212-433-9692. Millicent from Queens Village, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Millicent.
Yeah, I go to a club here in Queens, and most of the people are anti-Trump. Women, of course, and in the immigrant West Indian community, people are distressed because ICE officers are picking people up in local restaurants and even on the street. And if Mr. Trump thinks he can fix immigration reform by grabbing people on the street, I don't think it's a good idea.
They're picking up West Indians? I always thought that it was either people from Latin America or from Muslim countries.
They're picking up anybody that looks black or brown.
And so what reasons are they giving?
There's a possibility of being stopped and questioned.
Mm-hmm. What are they asking people?
Asking for your ID.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't walk around with my passport, so...
No, but you should have a driver's license, I guess.
I don't drive.
And there have been tapes, videotapes going around from American blacks who have been stopped with the assumption that they're not from here.
Mm-hmm.
And so the videotapes have been received in the West Indian and black community, and we think most of us... that Mr. Trump is a disgusting man, and he's a divider, and he's cruel and inhumane.
Okay, well, getting back to the topic at hand, have you spoken to Trump supporters to express your opinions?
No, I spoke to some women who hated Hillary, and they were all white, six white women, and they hated her because she's a criminal and a crook. And other than that, I have not spoken to any supporters.
So they didn't convince you that Hillary was a criminal and a crook, and you haven't convinced any of them that that Trump is a bad man as you see it?
Well, I tried, but they were so against Hillary that you couldn't get through.
Thank you for calling us, Millicent.
Yeah, but people are afraid of Trump. He's a nasty man.
Okay, well, he said Barack Obama is a nasty man. Nick from Huntington, Long Island, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I was just wondering, I mean, back in the early 60s and 70s, you had the Summer of Love and everything like that. What happened to all these people who were self-proclaimed hippies? I mean, you had a bunch of people who proclaimed to want free love and everything like that, and now we've come full circle to a point where they listen nothing but AM radio, write news, and I just don't understand what happened in this 40 or 50 years transformation. I'll take my comment off the air as well.
Well, I have no comment for it other than that there are some people who say many people get more conservative as they get older. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yes and no. I mean, the thing is, though, it was just such an utter, it's just an utter divide. I mean, after a while, I have to know what point, at what was the straw that broke the camel's back, though, you know? I mean, it has
well, are you running some... into, are you running into a lot of people who disagree with your politics?
Young and old. I myself am 27 years old. I'm very active on Facebook, but at the same time, you know, you see a lot of older adults who they have beliefs on the left. They believe left their entire life, and now all of a sudden they're Trump supporters. Mm-hmm. I've heard a lot about the Reagan Democrats, but you know, it just doesn't make any sense though. These people, they believed in women's rights, they believed in marijuana reform, and now all of a sudden they embrace Trump fully, and I don't understand how they could have got there so quickly and so fast.
Well, maybe they feel betrayed by the Democratic Party. Many people felt abandoned by the Democratic Party, and Donald Trump's campaign involved talking about remembering the forgotten people.
Mm.
And you're out in Huntington, Long Island. Do you think that it would be different if you were living in the city and meeting similar kinds of people?
I think it might be. Out in Huntington, there's a lot of conservatism. There's a lot of conservatism all in Suffolk County and some of Nassau. And it's really surprising to me, though, considering the amount of immigration that we have over here. I mean, there are Spanish enclaves, there are white enclaves, and they all seem very, very, very separated, especially, let's say, if you go from, like, if you go to Hempstead to a town just to the north, if you go to, let's see, if you go to Garden City, which is right next to, Hempstead, and you could literally see the line. I mean, there's no doubt in the income inequality. You could see on one side there's very, very, very poor area in Hempstead, and as soon as you cross the line, right into Garden City, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't understand though how we haven't taken from one another, either community, and have learned from each other, but yet we're just also conservative about it.
Well, there's that old line about being on the wrong side of the tracks or the right side of the tracks, and that's kind of what you're talking about there. Thank you for calling us. Spencer from Fairfield, Connecticut, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. I just wanted to draw a contrast between, I'm a theater and film producer, and I spend a lot of time working in London and L.A., and I find almost everyone I know in L.A., 95% are terribly, terribly against Trump and find it embarrassing that he's been elected president, and they just can do nothing but just express great horror over this whole development. Whereas in London, I find that most of my friends, who are tend to be on the liberal side over there as well, but they take a different point of view. They think America's wheels of Congress and all have rusted shut, and you needed to elect somebody that just was going to get in there and with a WD-40 and try and get the wheels moving again. We just had someone to shake it up. And I just find it very interesting because these are all film and theater people, and all from both sides tend to be leaning left, yet the English seem to be much more sanguine about the situation.
Now, you're talking about British, you're talking about English people living in,
right,
film people living in England.
Right, right.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people in the middle of this country who believe that that Los Angeles or California and New York are two poles, and then there's the rest of the country. I can't speak for London, but I do remember when I went to school in London, despite the fact that London would like you to forget this, when I was looking for a room, the signs would say, colored need not apply, or European only. And when I would say to my friends, well, I'm not a European, they'd say, oh, Leonard, you know what they mean. So perhaps some of those old Oswald Mosley sentiments linger in England. I don't know.
I think that I think it's perhaps, my analysis is that I think because they are more removed from the day-to-day life in America, naturally, because they're in England, I think that perhaps they just have a perspective that is not as polarized as many in America, that they can sort of stand back a little bit and say, well, things perhaps needed to be shaken up. And now I understand what you're saying, that huge swaths of our country think that things should be shaken up. But it seems that a lot of people I know who voted for Trump, because I have many friends who did that also, who think, oh, my God, the first couple of months here is not going very smoothly, and they're terribly concerned about the Russian investigation and the wiretapping claims, and they're sort of slapping themselves in the forehead, thinking, oh, my God, what have we gotten ourselves into? Whereas, again, I'm about to fly over to England in a week or so, and I'm setting up meetings, and all the people over there going, how is it going over there? Is Trump still going to shake things up? I hope this isn't going to derail him. And they seem to have much more of, a sanguine point of view.
Well, if this puts your mind at ease at all, whenever I have traveled outside of the country and read newspaper reports about what's going on back home, I always think, have they gone crazy? And then I come back home. And of course, when you're in the middle of it and understand that the world is a lot more complex than you get from reading what used to be the International Trib or whatever it is today, that maybe it is going crazy, but not crazy in the way that you imagine outside of the country. We are inviting calls from Trump supporters as well, and our number here is 212-433-9692. We'll take a little break, and I think we're going to come back with a Trump supporter and find out what he's been thinking. Give us a call now, and we invite a wide range of opinions. And we are back with your calls. We're talking about bridging the political divide, if that is even possible. Leslie from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, Leslie.
Yes, I really don't feel isolationist. I mean, it's not an issue for me being a Trump supporter. What disturbed me was what you were saying with respect to Comey and the FBI is that with respect to Trump's involvement with respect to any Russian hacking, there's never been any proof with respect to any connection between the two, yet Comey's persisting with an investigation there.
Well, a lot of Democrats complained that the Benghazi investigation was much ado about nothing as well. So isn't this a matter of who's in charge at any given time?
Well, there's no proof there, and four people died in Benghazi.
Yeah, but Hillary Clinton didn't shoot them. So it was a really...
She did nothing there, and there's a book written about that and her involvement, tangential involvement there. She didn't shoot them, but she certainly had involvement in decision-making there, where there is absolutely no involvement, tangential or otherwise, between Trump and any Russian hacking.
Well, that is unclear as of now, as far as I understand it. But what are your feelings about Comey's assertion that the Obama administration did not wiretap Trump Towers, despite the fact that most of the people close to the president keep on insisting that he did?
There's never been a full investigation by the FBI of that matter, as far as I know.
Well, he says they have looked into it, investigated it completely, and have not found any evidence of it.
From what I understand, there was no full investigation.
Well, I want to get back to the more important thing, which is the topic at hand. Leslie, when you have conversations with friends, do you mostly talk about politics with people who agree with you? Or what happens when you find out that they don't agree with you? Do you try to convince them that they are wrong?
A lot of times we agree to disagree. Sometimes we have lively discussions on the topic. We hear each other's arguments. Sometimes we try to persuade one another. It depends on the person. It depends on the situation.
And are you ever convinced that maybe the other side has some logical basis for its beliefs?
Well, I mean, that's a pretty broad question. It depends on the topic.
Well, for example, the birther thing. For example, the birther thing. Did you believe that President Obama was born in Kenya and not in the United States? A fair number of people still
really
believe that.
I didn't see any proof of that. I think that it would have come out had there been any proof that he wasn't born in the United States. No, I didn't believe that.
Thank you for calling us.
You're welcome.
Let's take another call. Stuart from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Leonard?
I'm well.
Good. I'm talking
well
to
enough
yourself.
Anyway.
You are? Okay. Me too. I think you're talking about a couple of things here. Initially, what comes to mind when I told your previewer was that we're talking about the dumbing down of America. People aren't listening to facts anymore. What is a fact? Okay, I can read two different books that tell me two different completely things. But there was a good article recently in the Foreign Policy Journal, I think, on people don't listen to experts anymore. And we're seeing that with the Trump administration as far as climate change and such.
Now, why do you think they're not listening to experts? Because they just don't want to hear what the experts have to say, or because we've gone through a time where we've come to mistrust experts on a wide range of things?
I want to jump to something else to answer your question, which is I think people believe what they need to believe at this point in time. I'm thinking that a lot of the Trump supporters need to support him because maybe they're unemployed. Maybe they are part of the white male population who's underemployed or unemployed. That not having necessarily to do with climate change, but people believe kind of what's convenient for them. The industrial complex is certainly against talking about climate change. So we do have a massive industrial complex, as cliched as that sounds, and they're against all this talk about melting glaciers and such. So I hope I answered your question there.
Well, I thank you for calling us. I think you have. We go now to Nathan from Yonkers. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. There's just a couple things I wanted to talk about. Just the first off is that I'm pretty liberal, although I try to think of myself more pragmatic. My wife is fairly conservative, and we argue and fight about this a lot. And it's usually my fault because I'm kind of a political junkie and I keep bringing it up, but she pretty much will just shut me down whenever I even try to bring up anything related to politics or the Trump presidency or anything like that, even when it's something so glaringly wrong, like his constant tweets about stuff like that. And it's frustrating for both of us because, you know, she is more conservative. She believes that under Obama and under the Democrats, the country's going in the wrong direction, that you know, police officers are getting blamed for more stuff than she thinks they should and stuff like that. And then I get frustrated because whenever I see something in the media, which I find extremely offensive or ridiculous or just completely insane, and I can't bring it up with her. I basically can't talk with her because we just get so frustrated over it.
How long have you been married, Nathan?
Been married about 3 years, but we've been together about 6 or 7 years.
So is this something that has always been there, or is this something? So you knew when you got married that you were going to have these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, we knew it. And for the most part, you know, we shut it, you know, either she'll shut it down or sometimes she'll be receptive to it and she'll talk with me a bit. And then I'll eventually just kind of pull off because I can see it's getting her upset. But it is frustrating for both of us, for her, because I keep bringing it up, even the small things. And for me, because I have issues talking. I mean, I don't have a lot of people I can talk to about it. The other thing, too, is that, obviously, I have a friend who's trans and who's very liberal. And I'm able to talk with her because our political views line up a lot. And, you know, it's hard for me to understand the point of view of my wife and the point of view of the Trump voter when there are certain groups of people that are being targeted or whose rights are being threatened by this presidency, and then to get the response from the more conservative voters saying that basically glossing over it because of whatever position they have.
Does your wife know the trans friend?
Yes.
Is she a friend as well?
Yeah. Yeah, she's nice to her, and she's friendly too. She's friendly to the church. We hang out together.
So how does that work out? Does she just simply ignore the fact that she's friends with somebody who's trans?
I don't know. I guess a lot of the times when I bring stuff like this, she feels that the media is twisting things, and that just brings me on to a second point I wanted to make. It's just really important. Is that there's just been a very concentrated effort and unequal effort in terms of size in in fighting with the refs, as I've heard it called, you know, just constantly challenging the sources of information as being liberal or unreliable whenever they don't support your view. And I feel like this, both sides do it, but this is something that's been very long and very successful and very almost standard playbook procedure for the right in this country for a long time. Anything that doesn't fit their worldview is biased, you know, and people, and you can see the fruits of that in Donald Trump, where people just don't trust honest, real journalism anymore. They just don't. They think it's all spin, even though there are factual things that cannot be disputed. And that's, at least for me, the most frustrating part in everything.
Well, thank you for calling us. And I hope you and your wife can work it out. Sounds like it's going to be difficult. But then I've wondered about other relationships that have similar situations. One is a very famous political couple, and they seem to do okay with it. Maybe the answer is for you and your wife to both develop careers as television pundits, and then you can appear on one station and she can appear on another. David from outside New Orleans. Hi, David. You're on the air. David, are you there?
Yes. My name's not David.
Oh, well, whatever.
This is Francisco. How are you, Leonard?
I'm well. Are you from near New Orleans?
No.
Oh.
The screener didn't ask me. I'm from Central Florida, but I moved to New York years ago.
And?
So I was a lifelong Democrat, and I moved to New York City. I'm here in Manhattan years ago, and became a Republican in 2008, actually to vote against Giuliani because I didn't want him to get the nomination, not because I was so pro McCain so much. So sort of a defensive thing. I'm a libertarian-leaning Republican now, but also a never-Trumper. And what I have found that since Election Day, I can have conversations with my Trump-supporting or even leaning friends much easier than I can have with my liberal friends or family. I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's because I grew up outside of Manhattan, but when I speak with my Trump-supporting friends, the ones that voted for him, and they know I did not vote for him and could not do that, nonetheless, I have conversations that are much more easygoing, and there's a lot more understanding there. My Trump-supporting friends will kind of look at me, and they'll say, yeah, you know, they roll their eyes, and they will say, God, I wish he wouldn't say those things. I wish he would tone it down, or I wish he wouldn't take that position. But they still can have a conversation. That's my experience, being in New York City. And I think this is just something which I don't know if it happens outside of New York City and the kind of such animosity that is against Trump, which precludes any kind of rational conversation. But being from out of the city, but having lived here for a long time, it's just an observation of mine.
Well, so you're having to struggle with the fact that you live in a city that is more liberal than you are.
It's certainly more liberal than I am, absolutely.
But I have to leave it there, unfortunately. I've run out of time. Thank you all so much for participating. It's been really interesting.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Richard Nixon applied what came to be known as the Southern Strategy in his 1968 presidential campaign. Donald Trump reportedly modeled his speech in which he accepted the Republican nomination last July on Richard Nixon's speech in August 1968. And in it, Nixon spoke of law and order and of building bridges across racial divides, saying, quote, Black Americans do not want more government programs which perpetuate dependency. They don't want to be a colony in a nation. MSNBC's Chris Hayes explores that idea and how it might remain a reality, though not in Nixon's sense, in his new book called A Colony in a Nation. It's published by Norton, and I'm very pleased it has brought Chris Hayes back to our show. Welcome back.
It's great to be here.
What did Nixon mean by a colony in a nation, and what do you mean by it?
Nixon meant it in this sense of dependency that you hear conservatives invoke, and, you know, Paul Ryan once said, we don't want the safety net to turn into a hammock. This idea of, you know, rather than sovereign individual citizens who are engaged in sort of flourishing self-fulfillment democracy. Rather, they're this sort of caste of dependents. That's the way Nixon meant it. What I mean by the term is basically a sort of set of citizens whose citizenship itself is somewhat liminal and constrained, and who the state treats much more like subjects, much more like colonial subjects in many ways, than citizens of democracy who have the sort of autonomy of self-government.
Nixon also spoke of waging, quote, an effective war against the enemy within during his 1968 campaign. Who was the enemy he was referring to?
Well, Nixon had a lot of enemies.
I know he had a list.
Famously had a list. I think that when the context of that speech in 1968, which is what the speech begins with when he comes to the convention center in Miami, is obviously the assassination of MLK had happened that year, riots across the country, huge amounts of social unrest, and also spiking crime. And all this sort of ran together as what Nixon identified as a kind of existential threat to the American project.
And years later, former Nixon aide John Ehrlichman said that the Nixon White House deliberately lied about the dangers of drugs to disrupt black communities.
Yeah, it's a stunning quote first published in Harper's in an interview he gave where he basically said, we wanted to identify, basically anti-war protesters and black citizens with drugs because they were both our enemies.
Do you see a deliberate campaign to disrupt black communities now?
I don't, part of what the project of the book is understanding the means by which we have erected the system we have that has such sort of staggeringly disproportionate effects. And the metaphor I use when you talk about a deliberate project, the metaphor I use in the book is like a magnet pulling thousands of tiny iron filings into alignment.
How have 50 years of law and order rhetoric affected the way Americans view each other? Did you invoke return to the 2014 story of Michael Brown in Ferguson several times in this book? That revealed an awful lot.
Yeah, it really did. I mean, it was the reporting in Ferguson, I think, that catalyzed the desire to write this book and partly catalyzed it because Ferguson felt in some senses revolutionary. And I mean that in the sense that the degree of humiliation that had been experienced by people there and the degree of fear on the part of cops that the order might get out of control fed upon each other to create this incredibly explosive and kinetic situation. And it was a sort of distilled essence of a lot of the law and order rhetoric and the justification for criminal justice that we've been building for 50 or so years. And it kind of catalyzed in my mind just how removed I felt when I was in Ferguson from what I would consider a healthy and flourishing democracy.
And it led to a lot of complaints about Black Lives Matter, for example. Also, hasn't the earlier petty theft that Michael Brown was accused of turned out to be questionable? But it looked like an excuse, perhaps, a reason, perhaps.
Yeah, so the context of that strong-arm robbery that we all saw on the videotape, which was released very early on, in fact, released before the name of the officer involved was released, which infuriated people, is that there's previous videotape that's now been released in a new film that premiered at South by Southwest that shows that possibly there had been a kind of exchange of goods that was a sort of ongoing arrangement. Although, again, we don't know that. I think the most striking thing to me about Michael Brown are two things. One is there's the sort of specific facts of what led to Michael Brown's death, which are contested and difficult to get to the very bottom of. Then there's the reaction of the police in the wake of it, the fact that his body was left out on the street for hours, that people felt that this was a sort of ultimate sign of disrespect, that the citizens of Ferguson were so worthless in the eyes of the law that even the simple act of moving a body out of the street out of sort of dignity and respect was deprived to him. And then there was the way in which that one incident cast light on a department that, as we learned from the Department of Justice, a police department that was functioning as essentially a revenue-generating device with very little regard for public safety.
And you say that American criminal justice is actually two distinct regimes. The first to be expected in a democracy, but the second more like what we see in an occupied territory.
You know, when we think about how justice functions, I think people just have such radically different experiences of the law. We have a Fourth and Fifth Amendment. We have procedural protections. We think of innocent until proven guilty. We think of I think a lot of people have a feeling about police and the law that's either remote or sort of vaguely warm and secure. And then for a huge swath of Americans, largely non-white, the law functions as something essentially external, right? That there's no sense in which the basic mechanisms of democratic accountability are there. And there's a reason, you know, I say this in the book, policing is a uniquely dangerous function of government. It's both necessary and uniquely dangerous. And there's a reason that we use the term police state to describe a state who is allowed to describe a state that is not engaging in democratic practice. And it's because the police end up being the point of the spear of tyranny. And so if you are living in the colony, if you're living in one of these places that are policed in this way, the use of state force feels essentially external. It feels fundamentally not like something that you are produced in creating.
You've recently been broadcasting town halls with Bernie Sanders, one in a mining community in West Virginia. Weren't most of the people in attendance white? Do they view themselves as being members of a colony of a different kind?
It's a really great question because McDowell County, which is the poorest county in West Virginia and the lowest life expectancy of any county in the U.S., which is where we were, is a place that I think troubles some of the divisions in this book, but also sort of brings them into stark relief. And by that, I mean that huge swaths of white America are experiencing a kind of material decline, a kind of deeper social decline, right? Both in sort of job prospects, but also in opioid addiction and despair and things like that. And I think so much of the moment that we're in our politics is the threat, the promise that was made that has guided so much of our politics from Nixon through Trump, which is to keep some set of others under thumb, to keep them contained, to keep social order by keeping them in their place so as to preserve a kind of flourishing nation for you, right? And the you is implied. That what we're seeing is the untenability of that system and the ways in which the problems of the colony are flooding the banks. And we see that all through McDowell County, and we see that through thousands of counties out across the country.
Didn't President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder continue decades of aggressive pursuit of drug use, even while some states were trying to reform their laws? How much does the opioid use divide along racial lines?
So the first part of that question is that they did continue aggressive drug enforcement, although they took a relatively hands-off approach to, say, enforcement in a state like Colorado. So you didn't have the federal government going in and busting big marijuana concerns after the state legalized it. That may change now. Mm-hmm. Obviously,
there's been talk about it.
There has been, and Jeff Sessions just gave a speech 2 days ago about the evils of marijuana, saying it was essentially functionally indistinguishable from heroin. In terms of the way that opioids have been received, I think it's been striking, and we saw this particularly in New Hampshire. You know, this was a really fascinating part of the campaign. You didn't have a lot of people talking about the opioid epidemic in America until candidates started going to New Hampshire, and in town hall after town hall after town hall, they had people getting up and saying, "My daughter, my brother-in-law, my coworker, my boss, my son are addicted, died of an overdose." And you saw people start to talk about it, and the terms they used were remarkably empathetic, particularly compared to the social conversation that happened around the crack epidemic in the 1990s in the inner cities, in which it was very easy to view these people as, quote, others, particularly in certain media circumstances. And the question now for me becomes the test of whether we apply the policies of the past to opioid. Do we reach for all the instincts that have been cultivated in the colony, the get tough measures, the crackdown language, the mandatory minimum, et cetera, or do we take a different approach?
My guest is Chris Hayes, who is the Emmy Award-winning host of All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC and the author of the bestseller Twilight of the Elites, Now a Colony in a Nation, which is published by Norton. Much of your book focuses on what's called the carceral state. What's the carceral state?
America, you know, one of the great paradoxes, perhaps the most intense one, is that the beacon of liberty, this city on a hill, is also the most incarcerated nation on earth. The statistic that always brings me up short, there's two. One is the U.S. has about 5% of the world's population. One out of every four prisoners in the world, across all the continents, China, Russia, the entire continent of Africa, all of Europe, one in four is an American. There are as many Americans under some form of penal supervision, whether parole, probation, jail, prison, as a percentage of the population, it rivals the percentage of Russians in the gulag in the years of Stalin. So for a nation that prides itself on freedom, there is just a shocking degree of our population that we have put under the thumb of containment.
Hasn't the crime rate been going down for years, despite what President Trump has said, that the murder rate is at its highest in 47 years?
You know, I'm glad you asked that, because one of the core parts of this book is reckoning with this thing that happened in America that we still don't fully understand. From 1966, the year of the Watts riots, to about 1991, we saw an unprecedented jump in crimes. And it was across every category, in every geographical location, in big cities and small cities. And it fundamentally changed the fabric of American society. America became a much more violent and much more crime-ridden place during those period of years. And then it reversed. From about 1992 to about 2014, we saw a drop that was as steady and precipitous and as ubiquitous across all categories as the increase. And so much of our politics formed around that phenomenon. And yet our understanding of why it went up and why it went down remains incredibly foggy. And what it allows is for this kind of superstition, this sort of rain dance thinking, which is that if we danced and it rained one time, then we have to keep dancing so it'll keep raining. And you see that produces an opening for politicians like the President of the United States, like the Attorney General, when we do see crime start to tick back up in some places, to say that we have sort of angered the gods, that we failed to execute the rain dance this time.
Now, the crime rate was up during the Reagan years, and that's why the prison population began to boom. But some people are saying that laws like three strikes and the like, encouraged by the Clinton administration, played a major role in the kind of prison population you're talking about now.
Right. So one thing I think it's really important when we think about the size of the American criminal justice system is that the federal government is a small, small slice of it. A very small percentage of prisoners are in federal prisons. And if you let out every federal nonviolent drug offender, for instance, literally let each one out tomorrow, America would still be the most incarcerated nation on earth. So this is a point that a man named John Pfaff makes in a great new book called Locked In, which is that most of what's happening in the criminal justice system are thousands and thousands of small jurisdictions that overlap in all kinds of ways: county systems, city systems, state systems, different jurisdictions within a DA's office, right? And in all of these places, you have all of these incentives pushing towards more incarceration, more punishment. So three strikes, federal drug law, the crime bill, all of those played a role in setting a kind of tone for how we approach criminal justice policy. But I think it's much more important to see those as effects rather than causes.
In addition to law and policing, are there more intangible ways in which people are treated in a colony? You discuss the humiliation of people. Isn't an attitude of superiority a key part of a colonizer's thinking?
This is the deepest part of this metaphor, which is the experience of humiliation, which I think is one of the most underappreciated force in human affairs and one of the most powerful experiences in human affairs. It is the engine of revolution. It was the engine of revolution for our own founders, which is to say, being treated with dignity or respect. We've all had moments in our lives, whether it was a boss or a friend or a loved one, where we felt disrespected. And there's a certain kind of rage that comes from humiliation, particularly when it can't be acted upon. And the way that we've structured our criminal justice system and, frankly, structured our society, where we have this kind of project of containment, this project of order in certain parts of the society, produces an experience of humiliation that is very similar, I think, in some ways, to the experience of being a colonized subject or being under the thumb of a authoritarian government, that the agent of the state can say to you whatever he wants, act towards you however he would like, and doesn't recognize your humanity. And in some ways, that is the deepest sort of spiritual, social, psychological injury at the core of all this, that even I think in some ways is even more important than the obvious tangible economic harms it does.
How important are voting and political representation to this colony status?
You know, this is one of the trickier parts of understanding where we are right now, because at a certain level, the Voting Rights Act, the destruction of de jure segregation, Jim Crow, did produce a massive shift in the political representation of African Americans in Congress, in local government, the election of the first black president. When you go to a city like Baltimore, you know, Baltimore is a city that has a largely black leadership class, that has black representatives, black police captains, black mayor, black district attorney. And yet the structures that have been produced, the politics that have been produced by white fear still resonate there. That magnet that I talk about that's sort of pulling these iron filings is still pulling on all the individual decisions made by Baltimore's political actors or Washington, D.C.'s political actors or the council people that represent the South and West sides of Chicago. And so what you end up in is a situation in which you have representation unlike you ever had before, and yet you still have these kind of systems that feel like occupation on the ground.
In 1970, Kevin Phillips, who was then a conservative political consultant, described the Southern strategy as a means of winning over Southern Democrats. He also said promoting black voter turnout would drive white voters to the GOP. With Southern whites now voting overwhelmingly for Republicans, has that strategy changed?
Well, no. I think, in fact, it's expanded. And I think one of the things that is remarkable about Kevin Phillips, and the thing to understand about Kevin Phillips in the age of Trump, is that Kevin Phillips, who was the mastermind behind the Southern strategy and the racial politics, was not a son of the South. He was not from Mississippi or Alabama. He was from the Bronx. And the laboratory in which he developed his conception of racial politics, his belief that you could cultivate a sense of besiegement and resentment and fear in the minds of a certain kind of white voter, was produced by watching the racial and ethnic clashes day to day in the Bronx, which is my home borough, in New York City. And that was then exported incredibly effectively across the country, particularly the South. And we are watching the same thing happening with Donald Trump, who is, at one level, it's paradoxical that this man, who is the New York City son of a real estate millionaire heir, connect viscerally to the voters of Erie County or Mahoning County or Kenosha, Wisconsin. And yet it's the same thing that Kevin Phillips was able to do, which is that it turns out that the cheek by jowl racial politics of New York City and the white fear that drives a lot of them and the resentments and fear can be very much mapped onto and exported out across the rest of the country.
But despite that, urban areas now overwhelmingly vote Democratic, while rural areas, which are more sparsely populated, vote Republican. That's in the North and the South. Do you know why?
Here is my theory on this. I think a lot of it has to do with decline and a sense of decline. I think much of what drove politics in cities in the 60s and 70s and 80s was a sense of decline and a kind of racialized understanding of that decline. The city is declining because they, black people, are moving into the neighborhood. They, Latinos, are moving into the neighborhood. They are committing crimes. They are victimizing us. What's changed is that as crime has come down and American cities have, in many ways, big cities particularly, flourished in many respects, though extremely unevenly, as we know, that same sense of decline is felt most acutely in places like McDowell County, in places like Mahoning County or Erie County. And that same script and framework now applies most intensely in those areas.
And they express a lot of unhappiness with the way things have developed. They complain to Bernie Sanders, see him as somebody, even though he's from the Northeast, as someone who understands their problems. And yet they voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. Are they feeling betrayed now?
Well, I think that one of the things that we've seen in the last week and a half is that through the first 50 days or so of his presidency, Donald Trump's approval ratings were quite steady in the polling averages, which is to say he was unpopular. A majority of voters did not approve of his job, but the minority that voted for him, between 40 and 46%, did. We've seen real movement downwards in his approval ratings since the health care bill, and I think that's an indication of the fact that ultimately what will matter to the kind of marginal Donald Trump voters in a place like McDowell County, West Virginia, is whether their life tangibly improves or does not, and who a piece of legislation like the healthcare bill helps and who it hurts. Ultimately, the rhetoric will be made a reality in some ways that people will have to live. And I am of the belief that the fundamental physics of politics still applies, that if you make people's lives worse, they will turn against you politically.
When he accepted the nomination, Donald Trump said, quote, "An attack on law enforcement is an attack on all Americans." Has anyone said that an attack on a black church or a cop killing a 12-year-old black boy is an attack on all Americans?
Well, no. And I think that, you know, there's even movement in some states, Louisiana is one of them, to elevate attacks on police to the sort of status of hate crimes, to create different statutory regimes for them. The idea that killing a police officer is a kind of symbolic act. And there's obviously there's something distinctly awful about killing a police officer, and often the law treats it that way. For years in New York State, it was one of the few crimes that for which the death penalty could be applied. But I think that you're pointing to something that is unsettling about the way in which Trump thinks about America and American strength, which is to associate the core of the country with law enforcement, the core of the country with its policing power, as opposed to the core of the country with, say, its religious diversity and freedom.
The Trump administration has issued its 2018 budget blueprint, and it would cut some agencies to the lowest levels in decades. How might that affect the colony?
So, great question. One, we saw a kind of clear colony and nation divide in that the parts of government we associate with enforcement, security, and weapons all got increases and everything else got decreases, right? So DHS and the Department of Defense, Veterans Affairs all get increases. Obviously, Veterans Affairs is more of a sort of service agency, but everything else gets cut. And look, the cuts to, say, community development block grants in cities mean further disinvestment and gutting of the parts of the country, and particularly in urban neighborhoods, that are the most disinvested and the most ruined by the sort of legacy of this kind of colonial system.
I wish we had more time, but I know you have to run. So thank you so much for being on our show again, Chris. Chris Hayes, the Emmy Award-winning host of All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. His latest book, A Colony in a Nation, is published by Norton.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.